Hi, my name is Nate Siegel. I'm 17 years old, and today is November 30th, 2019. I'm here with my grandpa, Ivan.
Hi, I'm Ivan Siegel. I will be 81 in 6 weeks.
Woo.
And yeah, here we are in Henderson, Nevada, which is right outside of Las Vegas, and I'm being interviewed by my favorite oldest grandson.
Tell me about where you grew up and what your childhood was like. Share some of your earliest memories.
I grew up in Philadelphia. I was a preemie baby. I was born in 1939, and right before the war started. The reason I mention that is because at the end of the war, we had what we called victory gardens, where we would... in the middle of the war also, we would plant vegetables and stuff like that for the troops. My actual earliest memory is of me being in a crib and our cat pissing in it and me getting blamed for it and getting punished. Needless to say, I've had cats most of my life, but I am not really endeared to them. What else? My father was a pharmacist, so we had a drugstore next to a firehouse. And it was interesting, you know, with the fire engines going in and out. Typical city living, trolley car going north to south. Cigar factory next door to where we lived. And a lot of people were there. That also was interesting, meeting the different people. Got some notes here. What else?
Okay, next question.
Pause. No, I got more. Oh, you want more on this?
Okay. Look at me when you're talking.
No.
No conversation.
Here, let me read off of this so I don't forget. I guess I was about 5 years old when I found out there wasn't a Santa Claus. My dad in his store had this yellow metal toy car that I wanted, and then all of a sudden it disappeared, and I was able to seduce the fact that it wasn't Santa Claus that gave it to me. It was actually my father. So that was a bit of a shock. After about 5 or 6 years at this store, my dad decided he wanted to try his hand at pinball machine business. So he bought a small pinball machine route, and we would just I'd go around with him, and they have it, you know, in the different candy stores or whatever. But he told me in later years the reason he couldn't make any living from this was that the mafia ran the big routes. So then he gave that up and then decided to go back and try pharmacy again. He was in that for about 2 years. While he was in the pinball thing, I remember coming home from third grade. There were two things that stick in my mind from third grade. One was I got caught chewing gum, probably bubble gum, in class. The teacher put the gum on the tip of my nose and whacked it off with a ruler. And I don't know how her aim was that good, but she got the gum and not my nose. And also sometime during that school year, as I was walking out of school, some kid that I did not know walked up and kicked me right in the balls. And that... outside of my back surgery, is the worst pain that I have ever, ever known. Pain.
What about your mom?
Okay. Here, talk about my dad. My dad, I said, was a pharmacist. He had a heavy lisp. He had a hair lip and a split palate, which sometimes made things difficult for him communicating with people. But he was one hell of a guy. My mother what can I say, was a hard worker. I did not have a close relationship with her. My parents fought physically and verbally all the time. And we really fought. There was a nasty environment to grow up in. But there must have been something in the beginning because they eloped in 1936, I think. They eloped to Elkton, Maryland, and got married on Valentine's Day. So, you know, who knows? They were divorced from each other, mind you, twice. That means they got married, divorced, got married again, and got divorced again. What can I tell you? Excuse me for using notes. I'm old and forgetful. Where was I? Okay, third question.
Aside from the bubblegum incident and the getting kicked in the balls, did you like going to school?
I liked going to school, but I was a poor student. My mind wandered a lot. I was probably ADHD, and, you know, nobody knew diagnoses then. A very, very poor student, bad habits. Concentrate in my early years. And yet I graduated from high school with a Bachelor of Arts degree from high school. And at the time, there were only two high schools in the country that did it. Central High School in Philadelphia and a school in Boston, whatever it was. And we're going to go through these questions too fast. I have to start ad-libbing.
That's okay.
Hurry up, Grandpa. All right, four. What was question four?
So what role did being Jewish play on your life growing up?
Yeah, all right. I was 6 years old at the end of the war. I saw people with the tattoos on their wrists and arms, heard all the stories, saw films and everything, and it was left me with obviously some, you know, very, very bad impressions. To this day, if I see an older German, I'm talking about somebody, well, I guess I wouldn't be seeing too many of them now, but they would have to be my age or older. I right away don't think pleasant things. I wonder how people could be brought up at my age, the same age that I am, and have all that stuff pounded into them and not have it affect them. Because I know how different things in my youth affected me. Judaism, I was not religious, I'm not religious. I was bar mitzvahed. I took lessons for, I guess, probably about 4 months, maybe five. Got in a trolley car and went to South Philly to see a rabbi there because I think my dad got a cheaper price than the closer rabbi. I was bar mitzvahed in the Orthodox shul in South Philadelphia because that's the shul that my father's family belonged to. And before I went up on the Bema to do my thing, I was flirting with a girl that must have been about 16. I had one of these early testosterone-type mustaches for, you know, the young teenager. And she thought I was older than what I was. And I remember looking at her as I was walking up the Bema and how she got red and walked out. And I thought that was kind of cute.
Uh, What do you think, as you've gotten older, you've kind of become less observant? Why do you think that is?
Well, I never really was observant. One of my problems is when I've got a very strong belief in God. I pray every day, and it's not your. My son seems to think that it was something I just started when I got older, but I've been doing that probably since my 20s or earlier. I feel uncomfortable because I don't understand and I can't read Hebrew, and it's an uncomfortable environment for me. I don't know how else to explain that. I'm very proud of being Jewish. It's like a peoplehood. We're the chosen people. And I feel strongly about that. I have experienced a fair amount of anti-Semitism in my life that I tell my son about, and I tell him to tell his sons about, and I don't know how well that's gotten through, but it's out there again. The Jews are to blame for everything.
What jobs did you have when you were a teenager, and what did you do with the money that you earned?
Well, the money I earned I spent on a girl that I was going with, but that's another story. One job I had, well, I worked in my dad's drugstore all the time, and I would bitch about the fact that I worked in the store so many hours while everybody was outside playing stickball and everything. But it taught me a lot of things. It taught me responsibility, how to count money.
That's an important one.
Before the registers, did it for you. I went and applied for one job at a first storage factory. So I went there, and the guy asked for a social security number, which I gave him, and he asked for a selective service card. I was 14 years old. I had no idea what a selective service card was. So I ended up working there for 3 days before I found out that it was a draft card. But while I was working there, another story of it, and then back to this. In Philadelphia, in the cities, you would have like one or two square blocks, and that would be not a gang, but a group of kids. And if you went out of that, you were probably friendly with the people in the next small group. And then after that, it got less and less. One night, the guys decided to go to this fish place and get French fries. And it was like about a 7 or 8 block walk. And it was a black neighborhood. And we went in, we got the French fries, we came out, and there were four of us. There were 5 or 6 guys in their, early mid-teens, standing there. And, they're just going, what are you doing in our neighborhood, this and that? We came to get French fries, and we're not bothering anybody, and we're going to leave. And then all of a sudden, this little guy comes up, swings a soda bottle. Fortunately, it wasn't broken. And whacked me right in the side of my arm, right here. And I'm not thinking, pulled my arm back to swing a punch on him, and this humongous guy just came out of nowhere and said, no, don't do that. Turn around and go home. So we turned around and we went home. And the other guys were scared. And for about halfway, I was just moaning and bitching that I should get that little guy and strangle him. And by the time I got home, they were calmed down. And I was so scared, I couldn't believe it. I thought they were going to be coming after me and laying out and waiting for me and everything else. Now, the whole point to that story is when I went to the fur factory, they sent me in the back to pound out furs and store them and do whatever. And all of a sudden, this humongous big guy comes walking out. he was the guy that stopped the fight the week before. And he said to me, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I do." And he said, "Okay, not a problem. This is what you need to do. Go to work." So that was an interesting story. But after 3 days, like I said, without the Selective Service card, couldn't do anything. Got another job putting bottom stops in zippers. That's something people don't think about. If you pull a zipper down, there's a little clip. Sorry, it's a little cut. Okay. There's a little clip, a stopper, that stops the zipper from going down. Well, you take it and you put it on the machine, and it presses down with a ton of pressure. And your thumb is holding it, and it comes down, like, right there. And I was doing, when I first started, about 1 minute, 1 or 2 minutes. And then after you get the hang of it, you start pumping them out. But it was kind of scary when you start thinking about getting your thumb smashed in that. And then the different stories about working in drugstores. I guess that's about it with that one.
Good thing you didn't get your thumb smashed.
No, I didn't.
Has life been different from what you imagined it would be like as a teenager?
I never thought about it. Never thought about what adult life would be like.
Just go with the flow?
Yeah.
Okay. What about looking back, if you could go relive your teenage years, would you do it?
Teenage years, no.
What about any part of your life?
Probably my 20s, maybe 30s, when I was out of pharmacy school and I had the direction I was going in, and I had some kind of maturity.
Are you saying that I'm not mature?
No.
I'm just kidding.
No, you have, you know what you want, you know. A fair amount. I had no idea what direction I was going in. By the time I got to my senior year, that's when I went into the Marines.
So what motivated you to join the Marines?
There was a book out by Leon Uris and a movie called Battle Cry. And I was a very, very impressionable 17-year-old. We had a draft. I knew at one time or another I would be drafted. And I didn't want to get pulled out of college. I did think, before I went in the Marines, and maybe I did have somewhat of an idea, I thought while in the Marines and pharmacy school, I thought I might like to be a doctor. But I didn't do well enough, you know, to do that.
What was the most difficult part being in the Marines?
I guess boot camp was the hardest thing. What they have to do is they take you and they tear you down, and they want to make a fighting unit. But in order to do that, because everybody is totally different, they have to tear down all the civilian habits and build up the Marine Corps habits. And you do everything by the numbers. You march by the numbers. You eat by the numbers. Believe it or not, you ship by the numbers. Seriously, you'd go in there and they give you a count of four. Some numbers waited longer than others. But number four was wipe, you're finished. Physically, kind of like we had a 20-mile march, which I never thought I would be able to do that, carrying, they said, a 78-pound pack. I know it was heavy.
What was in it? Your gun?
The rifle you had strapped over your shoulder. In it was a sleeping bag, a tent, a bunch of heavier stuff than they have today. Because I think a standard pack today is probably about 30 or 35 pounds, 40 pounds. We were told during the march not to help any other Marines if they couldn't make it in our platoon, which was 75 or 80 guys. And in the platoon, there were three Jewish guys, me and two other guys. Not a lot of Jews in the Marine Corps. And I turned around and I saw the guy behind me, Zimmerman, a tall, lanky guy. I guess there was still about 6 or 7 miles to the march left. And he was carrying the pack over one shoulder. One strap had come loose. So I got out of line and I took his rifle and I carried his rifle. And the drill instructors hollered at me for doing it. You know, leave him alone, you know, this and that. And I said, no, I'm going to help him. And then afterwards, they called me over, after we got settled in and everything, they called me over and they said, why did you do that when it was against, you know, your orders? I said, because we're Marines and we take care of each other. And they said, yeah, that's right, you did good. When we were up on the rifle range, well, we had one drill instructor. Those were the times when the drill instructors would beat on you. They called it thump call, T-H-U-M-P, thump. If they were going to thump you, it meant they were going to hit you. And you always got hit from the shoulders down because it would show in the face. So you would get, you know, you do something wrong, you know, you say you report for thump call, and they would pound on you. And they pounded on this one guy that was a senator's son, and he just keeled over a locker box and cracked his jaw open. And I remember the drill instructor coming around saying, what did you see? What did you see? I said, I saw him fall over. You know, did you see me hit him? And I said, no, because I actually had not seen it, or I would have said yes.
That's not what he wanted to hear?
No, no, of course not. And this guy pounded on me a couple of times. Well, more than a couple. But as time went on, we got squared away, straightened out.
What lessons did your service teach you that you still carry with you?
To complete a task, obviously it taught me discipline, because I was not the most disciplined individual in the world. The other story, when I was talking about with the thumping and beating on you, my last name being Siegel, this one junior drill instructor decided it would be funny to have me fly through my wings like this and go, Siegel, Siegel. And I thought it was funny. I didn't mind. And, you know, everybody was laughing. And then after a couple of times, it dawned on me that they weren't laughing with me. They were laughing at me. And the drill instructor decided to do this up on the rifle range with other drill instructors watching, because they wanted to show, you know, what kind of stupid booty he had or whatever. And he told me, he said, get up on this box. He said, what's your name? I said, Ivan Siegel. He said, is that a bird? I said, a seagull is a bird, yes. He said, do you know how to fly? I said, yes, I do. He said, fly for me. I said, no, sir. I said, fly. I said, no, sir. He said, lift your arms up and down. So I did that. And he said, now fly for me and the other drill instructors. I said, no, sir. So he said, all right, wait a minute. Go back to your gear and get me a razor blade. I said, okay. I went back. I got a razor blade. He put the blade, this is a true story too. No embellishments. He put the blade up to my throat, my neck. And with the razor blade, if you don't move it up and back, it's not going to cut. So he said, hold your head still. And he pressed in. Well, at the time I didn't know it wouldn't cut. But he said, now fly. I said, no, sir. And the other drill instructors laughed at him instead of me. Needless to say, I had thump call later that night. But having gone through boot camp is probably one of the three or four things I am most proud of in my life. Boot camp and being a Marine.
Somehow changing the tides a little, how did you find your way into the pharmaceutical business?
Well, my dad being a pharmacist.
Was it just that he wanted you to follow, do the same thing that he did?
No, I don't think he necessarily wanted me to follow. I went to Temple University for one semester before taking liberal arts. And I remember there was a question in there about Walden Pond, Henry Thoreau. And I wrote an answer, and the teacher marked it wrong, because it was the way I interpreted it. And I think the teacher was probably maybe a year or two older than I was. And I said, is this a logical answer? He said, yeah, it's a very good answer, but it's not what Thoreau meant. And I said, how do you know what Thoreau meant when you weren't there? Because it's understood what he meant. I said, but you just got done telling me that this made sense. And then I felt myself losing my temper, which I was known to have. And then I, you know, took the failing grade for that thing, that particular test, and then decided I didn't want to do something that was left for interpretation. I wanted to go do something that was black and white. You know, if you added this to that, you got this. Besides, I enjoyed working in my dad's pharmacy or drugstore. Those were the days of little small neighborhood pharmacies. It's not something that you see today. It would be something that would just take care of, you know, a couple city blocks.
What lessons has working taught you?
Responsibility. To listen to people, to be empathetic, to realize that people do have serious problems and they do hurt. And when you're younger, you know, you don't think about that. You get older and you start hurting. Yeah, you can relate to that. But when you're younger, you don't think that way. You know, your head's up your ass, you want to make money. And, but yeah, taught me that.
How did you and God meet? Can you describe your first date or the first time you met?
Well, there was one of
okay.
that, no, this is part of another question.
Yeah.
Like I said, remember that I gotta write some of this stuff down. How did we meet? Well, we worked for the same outfit back east, Dart Drugs, which is no longer in existence. We were both previously married. We were not in, obviously, happy relations. This was also the 60s.
How old were you?
How old was I? I was 26, 27. Neither one of us could have children. They checked me. They said I had a low sperm count. And I took some kind of hormone shots for 6 or 8 months that was supposed to take care of that. And it did, and there still was nothing. And it was like when my daughter was born, the doctor, apparently Marlene, told the doctor this story, and he just said, wrong vagina, wrong penis. And our first date. Our first date was to a titty bar. Marlene says that's not what it was. It wasn't topless because you couldn't have topless then. They had pasties. But I called it a titty bar.
I wonder whose idea that was.
I would have to look back on it and think mine. Yeah, she didn't have any idea where we were going until we got there. But, yep, that was our first date.
How did it go?
Good. I spoke to her. She spoke to me. I don't think she looked at anybody besides me. I don't know that I looked at anybody besides her either.
At the titty bar?
At the titty bar. No, I must have. Come on. Yeah. But I want that implant. I want to look at somebody for more, I don't know, 30 or 40 seconds.
Over the years, what have you learned from God?
Patience. I have very little patience. And I have to look at the notes to see what I wrote, to see what I learned from her. What did I write? Oh, yeah, something very important. Yeah. That if we made a mistake with our son or daughter and we punished them and we were wrong, we thought nothing of not only admitting that we were wrong, but saying we were sorry. We would always do that. I don't think there was a time we missed. That's what I learned from her. And also, she wasn't crazy about titty bars.
What was it like when you found out that you were going to be a dad?
Just absolutely unbelievable. It was like in the old movies, in the movies of the 40s and the 50s, people would go, wow, and jump up and down and be all bubbly and effervescent and stammer over themselves, stumble over themselves. And that's exactly the way I was. I wasn't one of these people, how did that happen? I was old enough to know how it happened. Yes, right vagina, right penis. But it was just, it was a fantastic feeling. Unbelievable.
Who's had the greatest impact on you, and what did they tell you? If you had to choose one.
Okay, a single individual?
Doesn't have to be.
No, okay. First would be my father. My father taught me honesty. A sense of humor, which is very, very important. And how important my name is, credit-wise, in all aspects of life, that when the name Ivan Siegel would come up, hopefully people had many more good things to say about me than bad, because I was not hopefully a bad individual. There was a geometry teacher in high school that I can't explain what it was he did besides flunk me. I never passed high school geometry. He said to me his name was Dr. Pennypacker. I remember that to this day. He told me I could pass you on into geometry too, which is broken down into semesters, or it was geometry A and B, whatever. He says, you're not going to understand that, and you're only going to flunk out of that. He says, or I can just have you take this over again. And I actually looked at him and I thanked him. And this was the smart-ass, wild high school kid. And this guy, Len Winkleman, may he rest in peace, friend of mine from the first day of pharmacy school. I saw him outside with a clipboard in his hand, and he looked like he had an idea what he was doing. So I went over and introduced myself to him, and we became steadfast friends ever since. And what he taught me was the value of true friendship. One day when I was working, and I was extremely busy filling prescriptions, the telephone rang, and my mind is on filling the prescription, people hollering, what's taking so long, somebody hollering, there's a doctor on the phone, and all the other stuff that goes on there. And I pick the phone up, and I go, hello, and there's this loud belch on the phone. And automatically I said, hi, Len. And I hadn't spoken to him in a couple of months because he was out of the country. And he had since been very, very successful in business over the years. But what true friendship is, and probably you go through life and you can have a lot of acquaintances, but maybe only one or two, maybe three real friends. I mean, they would do anything for you. When I found out that I was sick with MS, I was back east and I was talking to him, and I went and said, and I wasn't thinking that my wife makes a good salary, so I wouldn't need to ask him this, but I asked him, I said, Len, if something happens to me, I said, would you consider taking care of my kids? Or, their schools and everything else, and adopting them. I don't know why I said adopt. Marlene wasn't with me. She was back home. I just went to see him. And I don't know why I phrased it the way I did. And she was also, like I said, making a good living. He came back the next day, and he said he had spoken to his wife, and he would make sure that both of them got a college education, that he would pay for it. He says, probably went to Yale or Harvard, but he would send them to school. And that's the type of person that you count on. And when his wife died, me feeling as sick as I did, I went back and I saw him, stayed with him. That's what friends do. Again, what I would pass on to future generations, not knowing what it will be like with all the artificial intelligence and the retraining people have and everything else, of just how important it is that money is not everything, that you work at what you do and find something that gives you satisfaction because you spend many, many hours doing it, and enjoy your family. If you have a lot of money working, fine, more power to it. But you only need enough for basic essentials. A car is a car. A TV set, no matter the small one, a giant one, is a TV set. Easy for me to say, I got four of them. the last car that I had, I kept for 17 years. It was a PT Cruiser because I loved the car. And I used to trade cars in every 3 years. It's sports cars and all the other stuff. But the car is just transportation from A to B. Clothes. You got a $500 suit, $250 suit. whatever. The important thing is above the essentials, everything is just a luxury, and you have to draw the line of where luxuries go. And the way I would like people to remember me is that I had a good sense of humor, which my father taught me. I have on his headstone, not good father, and you know, good, well, it wouldn't be good husband, but, you know, whatever. I have on there his greatest legacy, his sense of humor. And I would like to be remembered that way and be remembered for my sense of values. I don't know what more a person can ask for. And then, as my wife would say, be remembered for being a pain in the ass also.
Awesome. Thank you, Papa.
Oh, my pleasure. Was it good?
It's perfect.
Oh, super.